On the show today, Dr. Lisa Dack and Dr. Stephen Katz, here to talk about their book, Intentional Interruption, and to unpack the barriers that get in the way of professional learning and what schools can do to break through those barriers in order to have a more positive, lasting impact on student learning. It's no secret that many schools around the world are striving to make a genuine impact on student learning, and that gaps really do exist when it comes to teachers and their professional development, as well as the professional development of leaders. In knowing this, in 2013, Dr. Stephen Katz and Dr. Lisa Dack published their book, Intentional Interruption, based on highly intensive field work that they had done, attaching themselves to a number of schools to work closely with educational leaders and teachers in different districts in order to create long-term positive impact on teaching and learning, as well as organizational improvement. Stephen and Lisa have deeply committed themselves to helping schools to thrive and to increase student learning, achievement, success, and well-being. As the biggest predictor of student success is the quality of classroom practice, what teachers are doing with students in the classroom on a daily basis has the largest chance of making a positive impact on their learning. In their book, Intentional Interruption, Stephen and Lisa set out to identify barriers that get in the way of professional learning and to focus on what schools can do to not only identify these barriers, but how they can put specific strategies into action to interrupt these barriers to help maximize the impact that teachers can have on student learning. In this conversation, we do a quick tour of each chapter of the book, highlighting the key points written about and discuss what educational leaders and teachers can do to deeply foster a professional learning environment where everyone can thrive and flourish. Both Stephen and Lisa unpack the difference between being a lead knower and a lead learner, as well the important difference between professional development and professional learning. They give us a brief look into strategies to interrupt habitual thinking that holds teachers back and share protocols that can be used to facilitate collaborative meetings in more meaningful and purposeful ways. I highly encourage you to get your hands on a copy of this book if you are interested in knowing more about these important ideas and how they can be applied with consistency in a school setting. Thanks for tuning into this episode, and let's jump right into the discussion with Stephen and Lisa introducing themselves and the work that they do.
Thank you, first of all, for having us. We're really happy to be here. I am based in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and I am a faculty member at the University of Toronto in the Department of Applied Psychology and Human Development, and I teach teacher education and some graduate level education courses. And I really focus a lot on the psychology behind how learning happens. And many of the courses that I teach are focused on what we need to know from a psychology perspective about how learning happens. And Steve and I together co-teach some teacher education courses around inquiry and professional learning for new teachers. And many of the ideas that we talk about in Intentional Interruption, the book we'll be talking about today, are ones that we also teach teacher education students. And I do some work in the field as well with educators, school leaders, and teachers around this idea of ongoing professional learning. And at the moment, the project that I'm most deeply engaged in is actually a study that looks at teachers' sense of efficacy for their own teaching online during the pandemic. And so a colleague and I have been working on this for the past year, doing surveys and interviews with teachers, looking at their feeling of their ability to be successful in the online context. And we did some data collection about a year ago when this was very new for teachers, and we're actually doing a second round of data collection now, as many teachers are a year into teaching online, looking at how teachers feel in terms of their own efficacy and what professional development for teachers can look like that can really target teacher efficacy in particular.
Okay, great.
That's a bit about me.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Stephen?
So for me, a fair number of the same things that Lisa had mentioned in terms of my background. I am a cognitive psychologist by training, with an interest in how people learn, grow, develop, and perform. A fair bit of my work is embedded in school districts, as almost what I would call an implementation anthropologist these days. One of the things that, you know, we've come to understand is that we've got a whole lot of really, really good ideas. We almost don't need any more good ideas, but what we need to do is figure out how to implement them with fidelity in a high quality way. And so my model has really been to attach myself to a number of school districts over several years for the long term, and really get to understand what implementation means and looks like for the purposes of organizational and system improvement. I do, like Lisa, I'm a faculty member in applied psychology and human development at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at the University of Toronto. That's a mouthful. A fair bit of what I teach there is both on the teacher education side and also on the leadership side around organizational change and system learning.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And one of the things I think about, Lisa, in your introduction, talking about sharing some of these, I have the book right here. I ordered it. I had it ordered for the leadership team here, so everybody has a copy and we're reading through it. But I really appreciate that you're teaching these strategies and this kind of framework to pre-service teachers. What a valuable skill to have going into the profession. And, you know, I did my teacher training back at the University of Windsor Faculty of Education many years ago, and there was nothing even remotely close to preparing us in this way for these types of conversations. It was very much being taught how to teach, really no input whatsoever, and having your mentor teacher come and observe you and give you critical feedback. And so I think these things are so incredibly valuable. So I thank you for those introductions. And again, the purpose of having you on the podcast is to really unpack this book. But for the sake of time, there's so much in the book. We're just going to take a glimpse into some of the chapters. And I'm really hoping that the listeners will definitely get their hands on a copy, because I think it can really transform a school if you apply these things with consistency. But Lisa, I wanted to start with you by just sharing with us how the vision for the book came about and what the process was like for getting pen to paper. And then, Stephen, you can share what you feel was the gap that this book was filling in our profession, and what your biggest hopes are for getting this book out into the world. So, Lisa, why don't you begin with the vision and what the process was like?
Sure. So I think for us, when it comes to our vision, you know, so much of professional learning is about a mindset. It's about a mindset of ongoing, continuous learning. And, you know, you talked about how we educate pre-service teachers in this way. And that's one of the things that we really want them to know. You know, you couldn't possibly come out of your teacher education program knowing everything you're going to need to know about how to teach kids. Nor are you going to learn it in the first few years in the profession, because every year teachers are faced with a new group of students in their classes that they're going to need to support, with all sorts of different surrounding circumstances. We can look at, you know, what's gone on in education in the past 15 months. We couldn't possibly know everything that we're going to need to know to support our students, but we can know the mindset of what it looks like to be able to continuously learn so that we can teach students better. And so you know, we often say we are all in the education business because we want students to succeed. We want to increase student learning and achievement and success and well-being. And how do we do this? We do this by teaching them well. There is tons of research that tells us that the biggest predictor of student success is the quality of classroom practice. What teachers are doing with students in classes on a daily basis has the largest chance of making a positive impact on students. And so when we have evidence that students have learning gaps, that means we need to think about how to teach them differently in order to fill those gaps. But teachers are already teaching students the best way that they know how. So, you know, an example we use in the book, we say if students are struggling to understand fractions, then the research says we need to teach them fractions differently. But we're already teaching fractions the best way that we know how. So how do we teach them differently? We can't just keep doing the same thing over and over again. The way we teach them differently is we've got to go out and learn something new, either about the math itself or about the pedagogy around the math. So what's the best way to teach fractions? We've got to go and learn something new. And that's where professional learning comes in. We have to engage in new learning in the places where we want to teach differently so that students can understand differently. And so our vision is really about that model of saying the way we positively impact students is by teaching them differently. And if we want to teach them differently, we've got to go and learn something. And that's where the idea of ongoing professional learning really comes in, that we wanted to tell a story here of how teachers can best do that professional learning in the places where they need to, so that they can teach differently and impact students differently in the places where there's evidence that students need to learn more.
Right. Yeah.
So that was our vision going in.
Mm-hmm. And Stephen, what was the process like putting pen to paper, and how long did the process take to get the book actually out? Which came out in what year?
The book came out in 2013. It's okay. Not a new book. It's been around for quite some time. Yeah. And in fact, we have a couple subsequent books since then. But I guess part of what I would say in terms of thinking about the process is we've always approached the work from what I would call a development and research process, which means the goal is to actually learn a whole bunch of new things from doing some really highly intensive field work. And then to actually look at the writing process as a way to get clear on some of the ideas and then build a narrative of when we have something meaningful to say. So it isn't the traditional sort of pathway, or at least that some people would use, which is let me figure out what I want to say and then go try and make it happen. We work in the other direction. We do a development and research process. So get out into the field, attach yourself to real schools, real districts, real people, real leaders, real teachers, real kids, work really, really hard to understand what's going on there, and then use the writing process in the way that expert writers do, which is not as a thought dump, not as let's get all the ideas in our head and then just put it out on paper, but let's use the writing process in an iterative way to become clearer about how we actually understand these things. And when you look at the research on writing, that's called, they refer to that as knowledge transformation. So whereas novice writers would engage in what we call a knowledge telling process, get it clear in your head and then dump it on the paper, knowledge transformation is actually use the writing process to get clear. And so as we would work through multiple drafts, we would actually realize what we didn't know. We would say, you know what, there's a gap here. We don't really understand this well enough. Let's go back out into the field, figure this out, see if we can capture some more examples or illustrations of what this might really look like. Because at the end of the day, the success of this kind of thing is when the reader can really see themselves in it, right? When we talk about a hypothetical school, we want them to say, that's my school. That could be me. I'm that teacher, you know? I'm the one who feels, you know, like I'm an imposter in my space, right? I'm the one who feels like I need to hide my vulnerability or keep my practice private because I'm worried about getting judged. So that, from a process perspective, you know, that's sort of the way we unfolded. And then just to add a little bit to what Lisa said, we almost don't need any more evidence that high quality classroom practice predicts positive outcomes for students. But when you look at what we do in the world of professional development, the research, you know, is pretty shaky in terms of return on investment. We do a whole lot of PD stuff that really doesn't land in a permanent and sustained way that will ultimately truly change the way things are moving forward for the long haul. And so, you know, in environments with limited resources and the requirements where we actually need to get better at focusing, we have to start to really understand what dimensions of the professional development and learning process are the ones that are going to give us the most bang for the buck, so to speak.
Right. And that's what I sensed that as I read the book. I read it a second time this past weekend. Well, I say weekend because it's holiday here and I've lost track of the days, but it's that idea of ongoing stories embedded within the structure of the book, which is great because you kind of go from school to school and you share these stories from a principal's perspective, from a teacher's perspective that were really, really valuable. So now what I want to do is like, we're going to jump into each chapter and we know that we don't have a lot of time to dig deeply, but we'll just kind of scratch the surface a little bit. So we're going to start with chapter one, which is from activity to learning. And one of the things that stood out to me was the activity trap. So Lisa, can you share what you and Stephen mean by avoiding the activity trap when it comes to professional learning in schools? And you might even, just to frame it up a bit, just share the Greenway School story in a nutshell and the principal David and what he was up against.
Sure. Yeah. So I'll tell you a little bit about Greenway and David, and you know, which is a lot of schools that we know look like this. And you know that it's a group of teachers in this school, Greenway, who are wanting to work together, wanting to do good things for their students, wanting to go out and do PD, excited to come back and talk to one another. They have a professional learning community that is bustling with activity. People are always wanting to present. They come together. Somebody always brings a snack. I think these days we'd feel lucky to be able to sit in a room together sharing a snack, but you know, that's a typical PLC structure. They want to improve. They have lots of ideas and they're working hard. There are lots of professional development initiatives going on. One teacher recommends, let's do a shared book study. I read this book on motivation. Let's read it together. And the next teacher says, I went last weekend to a conference on numeracy. Let me share it with you. And then one day they come together and they all talk about writing report cards. They're working hard. And yet David, their principal, constantly asks himself, are they working right? Are they doing the right kind of work here that's actually going to positively impact students? Because if we go back to the model that I described a few minutes ago, we can't bypass changed practice. We can't just say, we're going to talk about PD and we're going to assume students are going to get better. How does PD positively impact students? It only positively impacts students if teachers change their practice because of it. And that's what David, the principal, wonders. These are all good ideas, but are they what's really necessary for these teachers at this time in order to be able to change their practice? Are they really needs-based? And we can talk about that a little bit more in a future chapter that talks more about the problem with typical professional learning. And so getting back to the activity trap, what David is asking himself is, are these PD activities in fact activity traps? Activity traps are things that are well-intentioned, where people are working hard, they're well-meaning, but they're not necessarily activities that are truly needs-based. And therefore, what they're doing is taking time and other resources away from the things that are the most necessary. So we don't have unlimited time and resources. If I'm reading a book about motivation, or I'm going to a PD session on writing report cards, I'm not learning something else. And so what we want to make sure is that the places where we're focusing our professional learning efforts are the ones where we have evidence that we really need to learn that so that we can change our practice and positively impact students.
Okay, great, great. That gives us a nice little glimpse into that chapter. And one of the things, Stephen, moving into the very, you know, in parentheses, the very hard work of learning, using a very specific definition of learning. And I really like that. And that challenged my own thinking because and maybe I'll share it after because I don't want to give away what that definition is. I'll let you share it, but please share with the listeners the definition of learning that is emphasized in this book and why this definition was so important to use as that kind of constant reference point throughout the book. And why is learning so hard? So take it away.
The definition has resonated a lot with people that we work with. Most people would typically agree that learning involves some kind of an experience and that experience generates a change, either a change in what we think or what we know or what we do or all or some of those. But what is different in that definition is that we insert the word permanent in front of change. So, and that really is the strict psychological definition of learning. In other words, if we change what we think, know, and do, but then we revert back to the way we used to do things over time, in psychology, we don't count that as learning. So in order for it to count as learning in psychology, the change has to be permanent. Now, people will often say, well, isn't permanent change an oxymoron of sorts, you know? And part of what we would suggest there is the definition doesn't negate the fact that you can continue to learn and grow, but what it does do is say you can never go backwards and fall back into old patterns or old ways of thinking. And this really came about because, like, we've all had experiences with professional development and professional learning opportunities that we knew had no chance of traction right off the bat. We all know what those feel like. But the more insidious ones that we came across were ones where we actually did see some early, almost green shoots of change in schools, but they didn't stick over the long haul. So we might see some artifacts pop up in classrooms. We might see a shift in language. But then once either the money or the external pressure or the surveillance monitoring started to dissipate, those things slowly just disappeared. And by the time you kind of got to year three, you were hard pressed to ever have seen evidence of it in the first place. And it wasn't that anybody woke up one day and said, let's not do this anymore. You know, they're not watching. It just kind of started to disappear. And what that meant was that we hadn't really engaged in a true conceptual change. We had layered some new ideas on top of our existing thinking and practice, but we hadn't really changed the way we think about something. And this notion of how we really think about something and how that's really different from a conceptual change perspective is, to answer the second part of your question, why permanent learning is so hard. Because most of the time, what we as human beings do is we troll the environment through the lens of what in psychology we call assimilation, which is we try to make novel things fit what's already familiar. Maybe I learn about cooperative learning. I don't quite do that. I do group work, but maybe I just change the way I talk about group work and I start calling it cooperative learning. That's not a real change, right? For me to truly change how I think about collaborative work and move into a true cooperative learning space, I can never really think about group work in the same way again, which means I have to challenge my existing practice. I have to do a whole bunch of unlearning. I have to think about what the limitations are, and unlearning is super hard. So recognizing that true conceptual change actually requires discomfort. It requires creating a dissonance or a disturbance in the way we currently think about something, holding that discomfort in place long enough to realize we can never go back to the way it was, and then doing some new learning that allows us to rebalance our understanding almost on a new plateau or equilibrium, as we would say.
So is the misconception sometimes, because that's what I struggled with when I read that. I agree that learning is about change, a change in behavior, a change in what we do. but maybe it was my interpretation of it. So I'm not saying all people feel this way, but it seems like it has to do like these massive, big changes. But in fact, over the past week, when I've really been thinking about this, it's the micro changes in our practice as well that would qualify as permanent change, as long as you're not moving backwards. So even if it's a subtle nuanced change in our practice, that still qualifies under that definition of learning that you described, right?
That's correct. So it doesn't have to be revolutionary change, right? You don't have to recalibrate the entire way you think about assessment, although you might. But what it does mean that you absolutely need to do is actually thinking about what it means to practice in ways that will stick. Right? Mm-hmm. Because to get the output that Lisa talked about, right? So the theory of action goes, if we as adults learn something new and we change our practice in sustained ways, that sustained change in practice should translate into positive outcomes for students. Mm-hmm. But we have to change our practice and it has to stick for quite some time before we can see that payoff for students. So we often will, for example, encounter people who will say things like, I'm doing the high yield strategies, but they're not working. And of course, that's strange because high yield strategies by definition mean that if you don't have the yield, they're not high yield strategies. But often what happens is that what people are saying is, I'm not really seeing the impact of my efforts in this place. And those are the places where we look to say, have you really changed and has it been a sustained change?
Yeah. So it can be as simple as a consistent exit ticket at the end of class, you know, or at the end of the day, whatever, just checking in with the students at the end of the day, these little things that we start to implement over time in order to really see the difference that it's making. Right.
If those things are needs-based.
You're right.
So why go down the rabbit hole of an exit ticket, right? Why do we care about an exit ticket? We would care about an exit ticket if we were facing a student learning need around a challenge where we are not seeing evidence of consolidation of learning.
Right.
So we know that consolidating learning is a really important part of, you know, a three-part lesson, and we know a three-part lesson is a high-yield practice. If we aren't seeing the consolidation and we're saying, you know what, we don't think we're actually creating conditions for students to consolidate their learning, how could we do that? Then we give the exit ticket a go and we ask ourselves the question, is our practice around exit tickets helping us see evidence and impact that consolidation of learning is now more evident with our students than it was before? Otherwise, exit tickets, like Lisa said before, could be a giant activity trap. So we have to need exit tickets and have them map onto a student learning need.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was just going to say, you know, we could go back to David and at Greenway and we could see a perfect example where one of David's teachers goes off to a PD session and learns about exit tickets and comes back to the PLC and starts saying, let's all start using exit tickets. That might work for the teachers where they're seeing evidence that their students are struggling with consolidation, as Steve has just said. But if everybody starts doing that, where they didn't have that problem in the first place, we may in fact see that for many of them, it's simply an activity trap. So that could actually be a really good example of an activity trap or of a useful change in practice, depending on whether it's needs-based or not.
Yeah, great points. So we'll jump into chapter 3, Lisa, the problem with professional learning. And one of the things that I really want you to unpack for us is the difference between professional development and professional learning. And why is it important to decipher between the two? But also, can you just give us a snapshot glimpse into the ballroom metaphor? I really like that.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. So, you know, we've now been saying quite a bit that, you know, our model says, you know, student learning achievement and well-being is best predicted by high quality classroom practice. And when we have a gap in our practice, we need to engage in new learning. So how do we engage in that new learning? And that's what this chapter is really about. And the way we do it is through some form of professional development, going out and learning something new. And I'll get back to that professional development, professional learning distinction in a moment. The hope is that we go out and we do PD, or in our words, we actually learn something new. And through that new learning, we come back and we teach something differently because of it. But in reality, the research shows that the link from professional development to changed practice is often pretty weak. And the reason that it's often pretty weak is that it can be difficult to get from, as you just said, from the ballroom back to the classroom. And what we mean when we say ballroom is that so often, at least, you know, until about a year ago, PD is something that takes place outside of the classroom, maybe even outside of the school, often in a big ballroom. You know, you go to the hotel and you're sitting in their conference center with the nice chandelier and you're in the ballroom and you're learning from an expert at the front of the room. And the idea is that you're supposed to then take what you're doing there that day in the ballroom and get it back to the classroom. And what the research says is that it's often very difficult to get from the ballroom to the classroom. And we know that's just a metaphor. You know, we can be doing all sorts of PD sessions outside of the ballroom. Many of us have engaged in lots of virtual PD over the last year where we can have that same problem of getting from the computer session back to the classroom. And why is that? It's because the PD that we're doing in those ballrooms in these sessions is often very disconnected from the individual needs of teachers. You know, I was just talking to a teacher last week who I was working with, who was telling me that her most urgent challenge at the moment, she's a kindergarten teacher, and, you know, here in Ontario, schools are virtual at the moment. And she was saying, my biggest professional challenge at the moment is how I can help children with letter formation over the computer. This is something where she's saying it's extremely difficult. Things are mirror imaged and the child can't see me in the same way. And even when I screencast, it's not the same. And I can't see what their hand is doing. And I need these kids to learn to make their letters by the time they finish kindergarten. And I can't. That's my biggest challenge. And she said to me, so I had a PD day the other day. And guess what? It was about classroom assessment. Now, it's not that assessment isn't a good thing to learn about. Of course it is. It's important. But is it going to help this teacher with her most urgent need at the moment? Is it going to help teachers, you know, get back to helping students make their letters? No, because it's not about that. So why can't we get from the ballroom to the classroom? It's because what's happening in the ballroom is often not needs-based. It's not what we call just-in-time, meaning what this teacher needs right now. And it's certainly not job embedded. It's often happening at quite a distance from the classroom. And that's often the challenge of getting from the ballroom to the classroom. And it was Helen Timperley who made the distinction between the terms professional development and professional learning. And Steve and I use it. We think it's a really important distinction. People often use the terms interchangeably, but we really think about them as being different. That professional development is often about the delivery of information to educators. So you might hear teachers say, I got PD on whatever it might be, on assessment. Whereas professional learning is the idea that teachers are actually changing what they know and do in the way that Stephen was just talking about a few minutes ago. And that learning is only going to happen if there's some kind of change that comes out of it. And so when we talk about professional learning versus professional development, we really do mean something different.
I want to jump into chapter 4, how do focus, collaborative inquiry, and instructional leadership enable learning? And I do want to read a quote because I think this is very powerful and this really stood out. I was one of, I guess, confirmation bias maybe, and the highlighter story from the book, but this did stand out to me. If students aren't learning, it raises questions about the efficacy of teacher practices and subsequently the learning needs of the professionals involved. A teacher learning focus emerges from an investigation of what teachers need to learn to support what students need to learn. It is important to understand that the idea of learning focus doesn't end with teachers, because the same way that a student learning need defines a teacher learning need defines a leader learning need. So this is really a question about leadership, Stephen. And can you give us some insight into this thinking and the role that vulnerability plays in leading a school with purpose and authenticity in order to meet the diverse needs of students and teachers?
Sure.
So Lisa already helped us kind of understand the first link in the chain, right? Which is that a teacher learning need is a proxy for a student learning need. If a student learning need shows up, we really only have two choices, right? Get new students or figure out how to teach them differently. And getting new students typically isn't an option because parents don't keep the good ones at home, right? They send us the best they've got. And if it turns out that those ones aren't learning in the way that we had hoped, then the only other option or variable we can manipulate is our own practice. So we move now one step over and we say, okay, so as a group of teachers, how do we now have to learn something new so that we can change what we do to impact on students? We're really fond, Lisa mentioned Helen Timberley earlier on, and we're really fond of a metaphor she uses where she says everybody has a class. So for teachers, it's obvious that students are in their class, but for leaders, it's often teachers who are in their class. So I do a lot of work on leadership and leadership impact. And one thing I can tell you is that leaders, good school leaders, do not impact on student outcomes by bypassing the teacher. They don't go into the classroom and say to the teacher, okay, you know, you can take 15, go off and get yourself a coffee. I'm going to take over the math lesson and make an impact here. In places where we see school leaders make a difference, it's because they add value to teachers. Good school leaders make teachers better, and good teachers make students better. So everybody has a class. Everybody has to teach their class, to continue with the metaphor, and everybody's class has a set of learning needs. So once we end up in a space where we have a set of defined teacher learning needs, then the responsibility becomes one of the school leadership or the school leadership team or the school leader to say, how do I create the conditions or how do we create the conditions for teachers to learn what they need to learn? Right. And that's a place where we start thinking about people and structures, relationships, and all those kinds of things. You referenced vulnerability earlier. And one of the most interesting things is that people will often talk about how vulnerability is an outgrowth of trust, of relational trust. When you look at the research, it actually turns out that that's not the case. Vulnerability does not follow trust. Vulnerability precedes trust. So if you want to create the conditions for relational trust, which we know is really important for teachers to be willing to lean in, admit that they don't know something, and give a go at trying to learn or understand, perhaps even fail publicly, then we have to create the conditions for that kind of relational trust. That kind of relational trust requires vulnerability. Very difficult to say to somebody, you should be vulnerable, trust me. Oh, and by the way, I'm also doing your performance appraisal next week, right? Doesn't work like that because there's a hierarchy and a power differential between our school leaders and teachers. Makes it very hard for teachers to be willing to lean in and say, okay, I'm going to have an open to learning stance. I'm going to put myself out there. I'm going to admit what I don't know. Maybe I'll even fail. Doesn't work like that, right? So we know that one of the things that good leaders do is they actually model vulnerability. They give teachers permission to say, I don't know, by they themselves saying, I don't know, visibly and publicly in front of their respective classes or the groups of teachers they're working with. So when they say things like, I've been a principal for 15 years, and we've talked about comprehensive literacy for as long as that's been the case, but I have to admit to you right now that I don't really know what good guided reading is, that gives a whole bunch of teachers permission to say, well, neither do I. Now let's figure it out and learn. So they kind of help interrupt that and create a space for that kind of new learning by admitting and leaning into the learning need.
Yeah, and I thought that was such a powerful example in the book, and the principal admitted that, right? And said, like, I really don't know what it is. So that's basically saying, I'm going to learn alongside of you, and I'm going to be a facilitator of learning, and I need to get better, and I need to learn in order to help you learn these new strategies to ultimately serve your students. And I think that's a really powerful example of vulnerability. And I like that you mentioned it precedes trust. And there's a feeling, and as you described in the book, there was a collective sigh of relief in the room. And all the teachers were like, okay, I can take off my mask now and no longer pretend that I know what I'm doing. Very important. So Lisa, at our school here, we're seeing more collective inquiries happening as a natural development of professional learning. And it seems that as a school, we're going to move much more in the direction of collective inquiries. So what is your biggest advice for schools moving from an individual professional inquiry process to more of a collective inquiry process? And how can educational leaders in schools like this best provide the support needed to keep moving forward?
Sure. So I think my biggest piece of advice around this is ensuring that the inquiry that every person is working on is needs-based for them. And so one of the challenges can be, you know, if somebody else makes the teams and forces you in and you're on the team where the topic is A and you're on the team where the topic is B, then, you know, you start to question whether each person is working on an inquiry that truly is needs-based for themselves. And so I would say, really, when teachers are working together, ensuring that it is a shared need, that they're all seeing evidence of this in their own classrooms and therefore saying that those student learning needs are a proxy for their own learning needs as a teacher. And therefore it makes sense for them to focus their professional learning efforts in this area. Because remember, we are trying to go only an inch wide, but a mile deep. And so if I'm going a mile deep on topic A, I better make sure that topic A is a need for me. And so I think there's a lot of power, you know, in the book talks a lot about collaboration. And, you know, we could talk about inquiry and we could do it alone, or we could do it collaboratively or collectively with our colleagues. And there is a huge amount of power in working collectively. We just need to be sure that we're putting good collaboration processes in place. And so we talk in this book about how some of the places where collaboration can go wrong. Collaboration can go wrong if, for example, we just engage in what we call the culture of niceness, where the culture of niceness is when people who are working together are, you know, superficially validating one another's ideas and being afraid to talk about critically or to engage in any challenge. And so many of us have been in meetings where, you know, we hear somebody share an idea and we're thinking in our head, I'm not sure about that. I don't know if I agree, but I don't really want to make waves and I don't want to make them feel bad. And I don't want them to think that I think they're not a good teacher. And so what comes out of my mouth? Great idea, Andy. And all those things I was thinking, it's not really you, Andy, I just, all those things that I was thinking, I keep in my head. Mm-hmm. That's the culture of niceness. And the challenge there is that we've lost all those opportunities for critical challenge and debates and questions that lead to the kind of new learning that Steve was talking about earlier. So if we're going to have people work together, we better teach them how to collaborate in ways that really do lead to new learning. Otherwise, this can all just be an activity trap. I mean, there's so much more we talk about in the book about collaboration. I won't get into it here, but I think my biggest pieces of advice are make sure that it's needs-based for everyone and that people learn about collaboration. In terms of what the leaders can do in providing support for teachers engaging in collective inquiry processes, I would say Steve talked about it a lot earlier. Leaders shouldn't expect teachers to know all the answers already. They should model not knowing and vulnerability to help this process work well. They should participate in professional learning alongside their teachers and model what this kind of learning process looks like in all the ways that Steve talked about previously. And that would be my advice.
And so the two terms from the book, lead knower versus lead learner. So that's exactly it, moving from the position or the stance of being the lead knower to being the lead learner. And a leader, if they can do that, that's a great step forward.
Exactly. We talk about this idea of lead learner being, yes, I might be the formal leader here and there's lots that I know, but I couldn't possibly know everything. And in fact, many of you teachers are way closer to the classroom and to the students and to the student learning needs than I am. I may be at a bit more of a distance from that. I'm not the one who knows everything, but what I do know is I know what it looks like to learn. And I will model what ongoing professional learning looks like. And I will encourage you to do it. I will praise you when you do it. And I will even praise you when you do it and you make mistakes. Because with every mistake that you made, you learned something that you're going to do differently next time. And we need to praise those mistakes as much as we praise the successes.
Yeah, great. So Stephen, I want to jump into chapter five, and there's a number. So I'll read the title first, The Barriers, How Our Minds Get in the Way. There are a number of barriers mentioned in this chapter. So we don't have the time to go into all of them, but if you can just list a couple of them and just give us a glimpse into them. But before that, I do want to share another little quote from the book, which is, in order to get real professional learning, people need to learn to navigate their way through the barriers. And this requires intentional facilitation. Facilitation is not about a particular person, but is more about a particular role. And the role is to intentionally interrupt the barriers that get in the way of learning. So now, can you just talk about, give us a couple examples of what those barriers are?
Sure. So I think from the perspective of kind of the thing that you asked sort of towards the end of that, that really is the notion of intentional interruption, right? And if I link this back to what Lisa just shared with you, there's very few people who will tell us that collaboration isn't a good idea. People feel that together is better, that, you know, we should do things together. But in fact, what the research tells us is that there are times, in fact, a lot of times when together is worse than alone, right? I mean, we often say the only thing worse than a bad idea is a bad idea in a lot of places, right? And we also know, for reasons that Lisa's described already, like we've all kind of been in collaborative spaces where somebody says something or brings in a copy of something, and before anybody's even questioned or asked any questions around quality control, they are saying, can I get a copy of it, you know? So what we have to understand is that collaborative environments and collaborative spaces will spread anything. There's no inherent quality control, right? The internet's a perfect example of that, right? I mean, we should only be so lucky that when we search for something that we actually, the hits that we get, you know, at the top of our page are optimized according to quality, but we know that they aren't, right? And so from that perspective, to Lisa's earlier point, we actually have to recognize that the default practices around collaboration, in other words, if you just take a group of people and put them together, you're not going to necessarily get good things. You're going to get a defaulting to the lowest common denominator of agreement. You're probably going to get groupthink, and you're probably going to see people lose their individual identities within the group, and it's not going to feel personal or meaningful. So the cognitive biases we refer to are really mental shortcuts that all human beings take. And these are things that have evolved over time to, and it always sounds weird when we say this, but to really help people do the least amount of thinking possible, you know, because it's been functional that way, right? I mean, you can't, you know, every time you turn a corner and see something new, you know, enter into this whole new rethinking process. So our minds, for a lot of the time, actually try to conserve and preserve what we already think, believe, know, and do by helping us take these mental shortcuts. And what they do is, you know, they're functional, but when it comes to places where we really need to change, they kind of create some resistance, and those are the kinds of things we need to interrupt. So to give you just a couple of examples of what those are, one that's well known, and you referred to it earlier, Andy, around your own practices when you were reading the book, is the confirmation bias, right? Yeah. The confirmation bias is the notion that we all, you know, troll about the world looking to preserve and conserve what we already think, believe, know, and do, right? We don't kind of roll out of bed in the morning and say, I really need to find someone or something that will challenge me today, right? In fact, you know, there's two well-known proverbs, birds of a feather flock together and opposites attract. And there's only research support for one of those, and it's birds of a feather flock together. We surround ourselves with people who are like us, who think like us, and who tell us what we want to hear. It's great for maintaining existing practice. It's horrible for changing it. So the confirmation bias is this preservation behavior where we will look to justify and hold on to what we already do. Oh, well, the reason it doesn't work here is because this school is different than the one they talk about in the book. We have a different environment here. Our kids are different. You know, it's a different context. Our curriculum is different, all those kinds of things. And the net effect is that you keep doing the same thing over and over again. Another bias that is one that, you know, we hear a lot about is what we call illusory superiority, or what the literature calls illusory superiority. And basically, illusory superiority is this belief we all carry around with us that there is change that needs to happen, but it mostly needs to happen in other people, not ourselves. So if Lisa would just change and Andy would just change, this would all work out just fine. And then they could be more like me and how I already think. I like to think about illusory superiority as the bias that says I'm a legend in my own mind. You know, I'm a legend in my own mind. And so I don't need to hold up the mirror and really do the work. It's the kids, it's the principal, it's my colleagues, it's everybody but me. What's interesting is at the same time as illusory superiority is kicking our metaphorical butts, so to speak, we also fall prey to another bias, which is around the pressure we feel to hide our own vulnerability. So at the same time as we feel we are legends in our own mind, we work very hard to keep the door closed around the practices that we're unsure of. And I actually mean keep the door closed literally. You know, we walk into school, the door will be closed, and even the little window in the door will have brown paper taped over the little window in the door. So, you know, it's the height of privatized practice, particularly in places where we're unsure of what it is that we're doing. So at the same time as we believe we're legends in our own mind, we also all fall prey to what we describe and refer to from the literature as the imposter syndrome. This deep-seated belief that somehow we got to be where we are, but we're one mistake away from being found out as a fraud. And the best way you can make sure that doesn't happen is by making sure you keep your door closed, put the brown paper over the little window, and you don't say anything. And these are the kinds of things that we need to interrupt.
So the draft doesn't blow your house of cards down.
Yeah. Pretty much. You can go all kind of places with a metaphor, exactly.
Thank you for those. And there's, for the listeners, there's many more examples in the book. So we're going to jump into the last question for Lisa. And chapter six is titled Intentional Interruption, the name of the book. So can you share some ways to intentionally interrupt some of the barriers identified, in particular, maybe some ones that Stephen mentioned, or just you can list any ones that you feel you most want people to know about?
Sure. So it's funny because despite the fact that the chapter six has the same title as the book, and we clearly build up to chapter six all throughout, it's also the chapter that Stephen and I tend to be the most reluctant to talk about. And I think the reason for that is that our biggest fear when we wrote this book was that people would take chapter six, they would photocopy it, and they would start giving it out and say, this is what this book is about. Do these strategies. And our biggest caution against that is that these strategies only work if they fit a need that we have. You can't just start doing the strategies that are listed in chapter six. Then we're no better than the teachers at Greenway, who are well-intentioned, good ideas, but they're actually just activity traps because we may not need these strategies. These strategies were developed to fit particular challenges. And so I think that's just a caution going out that we never suggest, oh, just go try these things and hope they're going to work. They work if they fit a particular need. And so... some of the strategies that we talk about in chapter six are bigger and some of them are smaller. And so, you know, an example of a smaller one that fits with what we've been talking about today is the strategy that we call ensuring that activities and interventions are rooted in problems of practice. What we mean there is it's a strategy that can help identify whether initiatives that schools or individuals might be involved in may in fact be activity traps. And it's really, this strategy is a set of questions that people can ask themselves before engaging in certain kinds of PD, or that school leaders can ask teachers before they go out to do PD, that really ask questions like, what is the need that you have here? So why did you choose this kind of professional development? What is the need that it fits? What do you hope you're going to learn by going and doing it? How would you know if you've actually made a difference here. What kind of practice changes would you expect to see in yourself? And what are you hoping you would see in students? So really at the outset, asking a set of questions to try to hedge against this idea that, it may in fact be an activity trap. But probably our favorite strategy that we talk about in chapter six is the idea of using protocols to help engage in professional learning. So protocols, as many of us know, are structured sets of guidelines that promote effective and efficient communication and problem solving. They are really a set of rules for how to engage in a conversation that says, you know, in step one, somebody shares the problem that they have. In step two, we ask clarifying questions about it to make sure we all understand it. This is just an example. In step three, we start to describe what we heard. Almost always in the protocols that we use, we save offering suggestions and solutions for the very end until we are sure that we've really understood the problem to make sure that the suggestions and solutions we're coming up with really fit the problem at hand. But what's really important about protocols is that they help to mitigate some of the barriers to learning, some of the ones that we've been talking about already, by providing a structure that forces people to do the kinds of things that they don't do naturally in a conversation. So I gave that example earlier where I said, you know, maybe I disagreed with all these things that you were saying, Andy, in my fabricated example, and I thought it in my head, but what came out of my mouth was great idea. The protocol can really force us to work against that culture of niceness. It may force us to work against the confirmation bias, as an example, but it does things like actually says, this is the part of the protocol where you say all the things that you disagree with. It forces you to do that. And then guess what? I can blame the protocol. It's not Lisa being not nice. It's the rules of the protocol that said, I'm supposed to disagree here. It does things like it has some protocols can have a step. The ones that Stephen and I use often have a step called agree before you disagree, which says when you're listening to other people, our natural inclination is often to say, yeah, but he didn't understand me, or here are all the reasons why they're wrong. The protocol will often say, stop, force yourself to listen to that other person first. Think about all the reasons why they might be right before you allow yourself to say, yeah, but. That pushes against the confirmation bias. It pushes us to look for disconfirming evidence before we just try to throw all that away and just assimilate, as Steve said earlier. So there's many more examples in the book, but really what these strategies do is they help us to intentionally interrupt these cognitive biases that get in the way of learning to enable real professional learning to take place.
Yeah, and what you were just saying about not getting defensive and really looking at what they're saying, that's the same as what you said, the highlighter in the book. So don't highlight what you agree with, but what challenges you or what you disagree with. And then really start to unpack that. And also that idea of separating the person and the practice, right? It's not about the person, as you said, it's the protocol. It's about the practice. So that's a really nice way to look at it and a nice way to close off this episode. So I really want to thank you for your time. And again, I can't stress enough what a great book this is to get your hands on and to have a read of it. So I'd like to thank you both very much for your time. But before closing, where can people find you?
So we're both at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at the University of Toronto, and we are both in the Department of Applied Psychology and Human Development. A quick and easy Google search will take you right there with our names, and you'll find all of our contact details there.
Okay, and you mentioned two more books. So this book was written in 2013. Do you want to mention the other two?
Yeah, so the book that came kind of after it, and it's very much connected to intentional interruption, is called The Intelligent Responsive Leader. Nice. And The Intelligent Responsive Leader is really takes a leadership focus of some of the ideas we've talked about, particularly around the notion of collaborative practice for leaders who are looking to get better at the exercise of influence, right? We use the definition that leadership is influence, how you influence others in particular ways. And in fact, the protocol that Lisa was describing, which is what we call the learning conversation protocol, how to have the kind of conversation that really interrupts some of those natural propensities to conserve and preserve, force us into a stance of active listening, and teach us how to challenge each other so we can stress test our ideas, right? Because the point of being together is you need to end up somewhere that's better than where you could get alone. If together is just an inefficient way of getting to where you could get to alone, what was the point of coming together? And so the intelligent responsive leader has examples of the protocol that we use to do that kind of thinking and improvement-oriented leadership work. The other book, and I know you've had Jenny Donahue on this podcast before, and she and I have a new book out called Quality Implementation. That's a book that's really designed to look at the whole notion of how do we actually get the good ideas, the best practice, the evidence, the research-based practices to truly stick and take hold, and what's the relationship between that and collective efficacy. But I'm sure that your listeners had a fair bit of opportunity to engage with the collective efficacy notion with Jenny. And then Lisa had mentioned earlier the work that she's doing on an efficacy study, particularly in relation to remote learning in the pandemic. So efficacy is a big theme for all of us right now, and particularly in some of the literature as well.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you very much for sharing that. And again, Lisa, Stephen, thank you very much for being on the show today. And I really hope people get a lot from this episode.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Everybody, thank you very much for listening to this episode with Dr. Stephen Katz and Dr. Lisa Dack. And I hope you come back to listen to future episodes.
Listening to the Run Your Life podcast with host Andy Vasily.